A podcast of the cinema.
What's your name?
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film reviews editor for The Wrap, a film critic and TV recapper at What the Flick, and one of the, I don't know if I have a title. Anyway, I'm on Who Shot Ya over at the Maximum Fun Network.
You're a co-host.
I mean, Ricky is the host.
Ricky's the host.
Okay.
And you and April are the co-hosts.
Fair enough.
You are a co-host.
I'm a co-host of Who Shot You on Maximum Fun. And if we have any new listeners who wandered this way from there, welcome. And you are Dave White. You are also a film
critic. How come I don't get to say my own name? Where's my agency?
Have at it then.
My name is Dave White.
There we go.
I too am a film critic.
That's right.
For The Wrap. Not as many rap reviews as Alonzo Duraldi, because he's the boss reviewer of The Wrap. Also, I run things for this podcast, pretty much. let's be real here.
Hilarious.
Let's be real for a moment. You set up the equipment. You deal with all the technical things.
Mm-hmm.
But the day in, day out operations of keeping all of our subscribers informed of things, that's pretty much my gig.
Fair enough.
Yeah. The ladies at the post office will tell you that I'm telling the truth.
You are the outward-facing half.
I'm the production assistant.
Customer relations.
I'm the production assistant. I'm the gopher. I'm the doer. I'm the Mac in the back. You're the star of things outside of this home. But
speaking of subscribers,
yeah.
If you'd like to be one, go
we'll
to Patreon.
We'll talk about that later.
I'm just going to say the thing.
All right. Okay.
If you're new to the show, you'll understand that Dave White likes to interrupt me a lot, and it's real annoying, but he does it anyway. Go check out patreon.com/linoleumknife to find out more. There. That's all I was going to say.
All right. But we should, you know, I was thinking about this.
Oh, were you?
I've been thinking about
this.
You
have ideas now?
I do. I have ideas.
I got
some ideas. We should have, like, a tight 30 seconds pitching the subscription situation.
Well,
but not at the beginning of the show. And we'll have a production meeting about this later.
No, it's fascinating. We do this on mic.
I've got a great idea, and I'm going to tell you all about
it. You know why?
Later.
You know why a tight 30 seconds doesn't make sense?
Why?
Because I've gotten real good at hitting that 15-second advance button whenever people on podcasts start going into their, like, ads or whatever. So
right.
I like to slip ours in between things before they even know what's happening. And by the time they're ready to hit that button, it's already over.
Maybe.
I'm like the wind.
You may have a point, but I think I have a great idea.
All right.
We'll hammer it out later.
Because, you know, when I listen to real podcasts that have real sponsors.
This is a real podcast. We don't have any sponsors because we're independent.
That's right. But the ones what get paid.
Also, we're not big enough.
I'm like, oh, look, they're talking about Blue Apron. Bloop, bloop, and then
right.
Suddenly
well,
they're not
the
talking
same,
about them
all right,
anymore.
But you get the same Blue Apron ad every time. Yeah, you're going to fast forward through
that. No, even the ones who do a different one every time, I don't want to hear it. I move on with my life.
Well, this is an ad for us.
Yes.
All right. Anyway, we do talk about movies.
Yes.
On this podcast. And we saw one today. We didn't get to the press screening. We bought our tickets.
Yes.
We were
part of the public phenomenon.
We got up this morning. It is Sunday. We went to the Grove. Got us some donuts.
At Bob's.
Bob's Coffee and Donuts. Got us some dessert for tonight's dinner. Some fancy cookies over at Monsieur Marcel. No one listening is going to get to eat them. Just our dinner guests.
Who do not listen.
I would. Yeah, they don't listen. They're our friends. They don't care. Normally, I bake or make some kind of real from-scratch dessert
yes.
for dinner on Sunday night. Sunday dinner's the thing. People come over. They hang out. I make a big dinner. We watch TV. The heat wave has not, the heat wave is gone, but it has not gone enough mid to late afternoon baking.
It lingers.
Yeah, yeah. It's still very warm outside, which means dinner's in the slow cooker so that I don't have to turn on the oven. And if I'm going to bake something like I'm going to do tomorrow morning, bright and early before the sun even comes up, then it's going to be in the cool of the late night, early morning.
Yeah, we came out of that theater at noonish, and when we went in at 10ish, it was not that bad.
No,
but then we came out at noonish, it was like woo.
Yeah, yeah.
Hot.
Anyway.
Heatness.
Yeah, yeah. Los Angeles is why this is happening.
Yes.
We go see it, and I'll tell you something. Here's everything I knew about it going into this movie.
Okay.
I knew that it was a book by Stephen King.
Yes.
A book I had never read.
Right.
And still have never read.
It's a big doorstop of a book.
Apparently it's like 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
It is about some kids and a clown that wants to eat them. Then the other thing I learned about it, about the book from you, is that smack in the middle of it, all these 12-year-olds have sex together.
Correct.
Which is a tween orgy takes place in the book, a tworgy.
Please never create a portmanteau, because then that means it's going to come up again in conversation somehow. That's meant to be an abbreviation for a frequently used term, and I don't want that to enter the lexicon.
And then apparently in the book, the kids grow older, and they go back 27 years later. They go back to confront the clown that wants to eat them.
Correct.
All right. That's everything I knew. Also, I knew that the clown was named Pennywise, but the kids don't know that.
Right.
The kids just call it It.
Yes.
So
you only knew about Pennywise because of the band, right?
Yes.
Okay. Christy wore her Pennywise t-shirts.
Oh, did she?
On What the Flick
is. She's very punk rock.
She's so punk rock.
She is very punk rock. So the movie, also there was a mini series.
Yes.
I never watched it.
Really?
Really.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I have now, however, seen this film, and I'm an expert on all things that are It.
Because you saw the movie version
of the thick book. Only covers the first half-ish of the book.
Yeah.
Their adult selves are not in this film.
No.
It's chapter one.
At the beginning of the film.
And there's no tworgy.
Correct. At the beginning of the film, it just says It. And then at the end of the film, it says It. Chapter one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So these kids do not get down with each other.
Nope.
I was glad that it didn't. That did not happen.
Yeah.
I can't
see anybody filming that. I don't need to see that.
Don't need it. Don't need that. Yeah.
They also changed the setting. The book came out in the mid-80s, and the childhood portions of the book were set in the 50s, and then the adult portions of the book were set in the 80s. Now we have the childhood portion set in 1989, so that when It Chapter 2 ostensibly rolls around...
And it will, because this movie made $120 million.
This weekend alone. Yeah. When that sequel happens, I guess it will be set in 2016.
I guess. So, a bunch of kids, only one of whom I was familiar with. No, the kid from Stranger Things.
No, you knew the Book of Henry.
Oh, yeah, the other kid from Book of Henry.
Try as you might, you are not putting the Book of Henry out of your mind. And that's a movie that's come up a lot this week because Colin Trevorrow.
I do try as I might.
Colin Trevorrow got canned from Star Wars.
Is he the first person to get canned from Star Wars?
No.
He's like the second
There's
or third,
like a
right?
series of them. Like that Josh...
I haven't been following
the
that.
Fantastic Four guy got
because
fired
I just don't
from
care.
A Star Wars. And then Lord and Miller got taken off of a Star Wars. Yeah. And yeah, it's a thing.
I don't care. I just don't care who directs the Star Wars movies. Just make sure they're good.
Yeah, but don't you want to see...
So that I'm not annoyed by the fact that I'm going to get one every year for the rest of my life.
Don't you want to see the director of the Book of Henry suffer a little bit?
No, I don't know him. I got no problem with that dude, Colin Trevorrow. I liked Safety Not Guaranteed.
You didn't like Jurassic World.
I did not like Jurassic World. I don't think that was probably very much his fault at all. The Book of Henry is insane. But I have nothing personal against Colin Trevorrow. I don't want to see him lose a job. That's not good for him. He'll get another job. But you know what? Who cares?
I don't mean that you want to see him not... You want him to direct less, I think, is what I'm trying to say here.
No, I want him to direct better.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Better. Be a better director.
Anyway.
At the, directing.
The Henry from Book of Henry's in this movie, and the Stranger Things kid is in this movie.
Yes. And then there's a Skarsgård.
Right.
Related to all those Skarsgårds.
Right. As the clown.
As the clown.
As the clown.
So the kids each encounter slightly variant versions of the clown.
Right.
Based on...
their personal fears.
Their own personal fears and their own personal life circumstances.
Yes. And at the beginning of the movie, we see the clown snatch away Book of Henry Kid's little brother.
That was fantastic. That happened in the first, like, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That kid gets eaten like the boy in Jaws. And I thought, oh, good. I'm very happy now to be sitting in this movie.
They knew how to get Dave White on board with chomping.
You send a clown out, and that clown devours, literally eats a child in the first 5 minutes of the movie? I'm your friend. Movie. We're friends.
You have my attention.
You have my attention. I like this movie.
Yeah.
Here's what I like about it. The kids are all really good.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good ensemble of kids.
And it's an ensemble. Like,
there are seven of them.
Yeah, this movie has to juggle a lot of speaking parts.
Yeah.
And a lot of major characters.
I loved how it looked.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the direction. It took its time. It's well over 2 hours. 2 hours 15, 2 hours 20.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel like
doesn't
it.
Really. It takes its time because it needs to.
Yeah.
It works on a couple levels. It works on the level of this is a real demonic murder clown that will eat you. And yet also it works on that other level of this is the death of childhood. You must grow and remove yourself from your fears. You must become, you know, more thoughtful and wise. You must leave behind your childhood self to a degree.
I think it's also about you get the impression that there's something haunted about the town itself.
Well, yes, literally.
Literally haunted.
Yes.
But also it's about like the sins of the past have to do with the sins of our country's past in terms of
yes.
The Industrial Revolution and worker safety.
Yes.
With you know, race riots with,
yeah.
you know, or anti-race riots. Like, what am I trying to say here? With, I mean...
Racist riots?
Racist riots, thank you. That's what I'm trying to say. So the sort of periodic manifestation of humanity's worst impulses as an ongoing threat to the people in the town, and then there and as well as the people in the town who know that this stuff happens and don't do anything about it.
Right. There is the literal and the metaphorical, and they're both very nicely wrapped up into each other.
Yeah.
Throughout the duration of the film, and I was really appreciative of that.
You have parents in the film who subject their children to varying degrees and types of abuse.
Yes.
And you see the different ways in which that plays out among the victims of it.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot happening here. And I read the book and I saw the miniseries, and I found this really effective. And I think, you know, yeah, there are some jump scares.
Only one of those took me by surprise.
Well, you're
and it came later.
You're a hard case with those.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that this is...
They're easy to spot. They're easy to know that they're coming.
I know. Yeah. I've gotten better at it over the years. But
not much. I've known you for 22 years now. And when we go to
I've
a film...
But I've seen horror movies without you. You don't always know.
Most of the time, I know my husband how you're going to react. If it's squeamishness over something really gross, somebody getting poked with something like a stick or a knife or a pointy object in a soft, squishy place, or if they jump out at you, I pretty much got you. I kind of know what you're about.
I've gotten better at seeing. I know I've gotten better at reading the quiet that precedes the jump.
That is the trick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've gotten better at that. But yeah, no, I thought this was effective. The director, I don't have his name in front of me, is the guy who made Mama.
Oh, I've got his name in front of me right here. It is Andy Muschietti.
Andy Muschietti. Congratulations, Andy Muschietti. You are now the hottest director in Hollywood.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, no, I think it's very effective. And the updating works. I was thinking about how, you know, you could update this from the 50s to the 80s without radically having to shift the way the kids are, the way they are with each other and that kind of thing.
Right.
And it got me thinking about this whole thing of, and we've talked about this in regards to other movies, the sort of pre-internet, pre-cell phone story and post-internet, post-cell phone story.
Right.
And then it got me thinking, what's the next hurdle that's going to have to be a pre-post? You know what I mean? Like, where does the technology shift in a way that we can have period stories about people who have email and cell phones, but not whatever this other thing is, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I just remember watching House of the Devil.
Right, yes.
And thinking, this would all be fixed with a cell phone.
Yes. There's no movie.
And really sort of luxuriating in the lack of them.
Right.
During the course of that film, thinking, there's no escape because there are no cell phones yet.
If there is one moment where I felt some length to this, there's a point at which you realize that we have to see something happen to all seven characters.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, okay, now we got to check, you know.
But it doesn't feel...
It passed through my mind, but then it didn't feel like I was then sort of wading through oatmeal. Like it did maintain itself pretty zippy. So yeah, I think this works. I'm really curious to see how the sequel approaches the...
Didn't scare me at all.
You know, you're so tough.
No, I'm not so tough. I'm fairly immune to a lot of this kind of stuff. Killer demon clowns are somewhat more scary than creepy possessed dolls.
Mm-hmm.
But they're kind of number two on the list of things that just aren't that scary to me.
I know. You're scared of the strangers.
Yeah.
I wasn't scared in the traditional sort of horror movie sense of like, oh, I'm going to come home and search under the bed for clowns.
That's right.
But because this is a movie that is about people's fear.
Yeah.
It was very empathetic in terms of when you're a kid and you're afraid of things like the cellar.
Yeah.
Or the abstract painting, you know.
Right.
Or the whatever. Like
this thing that almost looks like a Modigliani is going to try to kill me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I guess I wasn't afraid as much as I was sort of empathetic to that stuff. And I felt the idea of the only way they can conquer this thing is to not be afraid of it. And what that must feel like if you're 12, you know, having to sort of muster that level of courage. It put me in their shoes.
Yeah.
It was interesting to see this movie after Stranger Things with the Stranger Things kid in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because so much of Stranger Things is built upon the sort of pop culture 80s, you know, the Goonies and it, frankly, you know, uh-huh. I mean, the these kids sort of rallying together, you know, when the adults don't understand what's going on.
Oh, and there's a lot of Goonies going on in this movie.
Yeah, but there's, you know, there's a lot of it in Stranger Things, so it's curious to see it now come full circle with the Stranger Things kid in it.
Right.
Yeah, I've still never seen the Goonies.
I know.
but I like this
one. You know what? You don't have to. You just don't have to. You're not, you were in college when it came out. It doesn't matter. You don't have to. Take it off your feel weird about not having seen it list.
Younger people make me feel weird about saying. Speaking of which,
you know what? Make younger people feel weird about not seeing things that were made before they were born.
No, I believe me. That's my go-to.
Two can play that game.
That's right.
Starring Vivica Fox.
Do you know what's coming for a week at the LCAP, by the way? Speaking of movies that young people always try to guilt me into seeing.
What?
Hocus Pocus.
No, thanks. I saw it. It's not a good movie. And I don't care what you say to me about it. I saw it. I saw it during its initial theatrical release. I saw it with children. I took a bunch of kids to see it. They thought it was fine at the time. I don't know where those kids are now. I don't know what they think about it now. I was a volunteer at an AIDS hospice in Dallas in the early 90s, and the kids who lived there, their parents had AIDS, and every Saturday I would take those kids and put them in the big 18-seater van and drive them all to the movies at the big town mall where it cost $1 to see a movie. Second-run house. Place was falling apart. We saw Richie Rich and the Beverly Hillbillies and the Coneheads and all the worst.
The Little Rascals?
The Little Rascals. All the Free Willies, all the Three Ninjas, you name it. I was there.
Your early 90s PG movies.
With those kids. And I saw Hocus Pocus. Guess what? It ain't good.
What about
the end?
This one I actually maybe kind of want to see, but it'll never obviously mean to me what it does to the people who grew up watching it on HBO or whatever.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Troop Beverly Hills?
Yes. Troop Beverly Hills is pretty dope.
Okay. I need to see Troop Beverly Hills. I think there was like an entire All Things Cozy episode about it.
That we'll watch that like over Christmas or something. Okay. Like when you don't have to
a million other things to
you've
watch.
You've got pajamas on all day. That's right. When you watch Troop Beverly Hills.
Okay.
All right. Know. Yes. Okay, so especially it'll be a fun look at, you know, our city of 20 years ago.
Right.
Okay, you saw, and I refused to see 9/11.
Yes.
For people who don't know that a film called 9/11 opened this week, because yes. It only opened on 400 screens and stars Charlie Sheen, Gina Gershon, and Whoopi Goldberg.
Yes.
Why don't you tell folks what that movie is about?
Well, it all is all set on 9/11 in New York City, and it's based on a play called Elevator, and it basically boils down to a handful of people who are in an elevator in the North Tower of the World Trade Center on September 11th. And so Whoopi Goldberg plays kind of like the building manager. She's sort of downstairs where all the you know, controls and radios are and stuff. And stuck in this elevator are Charlie Sheen and Gina Gershon, playing a billionaire and his wife, who are in the process of getting divorced.
The billionaire.
And his wife. Mm. So they're getting divorced. He doesn't want to, but she does. A woman...
What's he a billionaire about? What got him his billionaires?
I think Wall Street-y stuff, because it's Charlie Sheen. A woman played by Olga Fonda, who I've never seen before, who is there on some personal business.
Right.
A bike messenger played by Wood Owen, and janitor maintenance guy played by Luis Guzman.
All right.
And so they're stuck in the elevator and, trying to figure out how to save themselves, getting bits of information from Whoopi Goldberg occasionally about what is actually going on outside. Believe me, I walked into a movie called 9/11 with Charlie Sheen and Whoopi Goldberg with ready to roll my eyes.
Right.
And
so instead, what you're saying is that you had fun at 9/11.
I did not have fun.
You enjoyed 9/11. No. It was really entertaining. Okay. 9/11 was really entertaining for you?
Are you going to do this?
Was 9/11 really great?
Is this what you're going to do?
Okay, I'm done.
You're just going
to... I'm done
keep
doing that.
Running me over?
I'm done doing that.
And at first, believe me, there was nothing that convinced me that, that I was wrong in my initial assessment, because the cinematography is very muddy. Like, it looks like you're watching a bootleg or something. Like somebody filmed another film off the screen. But as it went along, I found myself getting into the performances. Like, Charlie Sheen's whatever. Right. But Luis Guzman, Wood Owen, and Whoopi Goldberg, even though she's wearing a terrible wig, are all giving very kind of solid, low-key character actor kind of performances.
Right.
And then Gina Gershon, bless Crystal Connor's heart,
right,
is killing it.
Right.
Like, she has this, you know, she goes from being like angry with Charlie Sheen to trying to cope with the situation. There's a moment where Jacqueline Bisset, playing Gina Gershon's mother, for a moment manages to get through to them on her cell phone. And so we have this scene of her and Charlie Sheen talking to the mother and then talking to their kid.
Right.
And that moment reached this poignancy and level of kind of dramatic heartbreak where I was like, oh God, this is the other side of those phone calls that you hear, those voicemail messages,
right,
that people who were in the building left.
Right.
And it made me be okay with the existence of this movie, because everything about it, I know, smacks of exploitation.
Yes.
But the way they do it, they, you know, they aren't cramming a lot of, like, I mean, yes, you see some of the footage of the
I just want to hear you say the word exploitation again.
No, I'm not going to. They show you some of the footage of the planes and stuff, but for the most part, they take this so much into the micro. They don't, it's not about the day. It's not like United 93, where it's like, you know, you find out what's going on in the control tower and all these other places. It's like just these people in this horrible situation. And it's not, I don't want to overpraise this movie. It's not great.
Right.
But it's not terrible.
It shouldn't exist.
Well, that's another discussion. But
no, that's the discussion I'm having.
But for the movie that does exist, is not terrible.
It should not exist.
Well,
here are other films that should not exist. The World Trade Center with Nicolas Cage. United 93. These films should not exist. They are exploitation films.
Here is the difference between this...
Remember Me. Oh, my God.
Well, Remember Me, yeah. This
just, also an worst. Exploitation film.
Here's the difference between this and a movie like United 93, which most people like more than we do.
United 93 is a really well-made exploitation film.
United 93 is well-directed, but the reason that I think that it's tragedy porn is because it is, I think, approaching 9/11 from the point of view of people, A, that we know are doomed,
right,
and B, who are part of the causality of the event itself.
Yes.
Whereas this movie, you don't necessarily know if they're going to live or die.
Right, it's fiction.
Yes, but also there are people who got out of the building. There are people who were in the elevator who got out of the building.
There are. That is correct.
And it's about people who are... have this event thrust upon them.
Yes.
And I mean, yes, the people on the plane in 1993 had thrust upon them, but I'm saying the actual disaster itself, they are in no way participants or players in it. They are just stuck in it and having to figure out how to get through it all. And so the fact that they were able to generate a level of uncertainty and suspense, I thought kept it interesting. And you talk about me having a hard time watching people get stabbed in their soft places. I have a real phobia about people getting cut in half by elevator doors or by falling elevators. And so that made me very on edge.
Right.
But that's handled, I think, effectively and not in a gross way. And ultimately, I think this movie is not gross. Believe me, before I saw it, I was with you. I was on the page of, like, why is there a movie called 9/11 with Charlie Sheen and Whoopi Goldberg? That's just why.
Why? Why?
Because as much as 9/11 has become this sort of political thing and the beginning of wars and that kind of thing. In the same way that From Here to Eternity exists not to exploit Pearl Harbor.
I understand.
But to show fictionally,
yes,
human beings caught up in a world-sweeping moment of history.
Right.
I don't want to say this is anywhere near as good as From Here to Eternity. I'm saying in terms of
that you even had to say that out loud.
I'm saying in terms of the justification for its existence, which is what you keep drilling me on. The mm-hmm. justification for its existence is that there were human lives taking place in that right. building when that happened.
No.
And human stories taking place.
Yeah, there were. And no, this film should not exist.
And I think that we're allowed to tell those stories. And you have,
someday.
You have this decision.
Too soon.
Sweetie?
Yeah.
How many years?
Oh, you called me sweetie.
Yes. From Here to Eternity, the movie came out in the 50s. I don't know when the book came out.
Right.
But Pearl Harbor was, less time had elapsed since Pearl Harbor than had elapsed between 9/11 and now to do that story. So your decision about when it's too soon and when it's not, I think, is kind of arbitrary.
My decision is final.
Well, I disagree with you, and I saw the movie and you didn't, so shut up. Just shut up.
Okay.
We are, however, fully agreed
on
Home Again.
I have something to say about Home Again.
Go right ahead.
Are you keeping track of the time where we are in the podcast?
Uh-huh.
Yeah? F*** Home Again. Now, you bleep that to make this clean for iTunes.
Duly noted. Oh, I forgot. You didn't even see all of that one either.
I saw 90 of its 100 minutes. I maybe sat out in the lobby for the last 10 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah,
you pulled an emoji movie. You walked out.
I did. I pulled an emoji movie. Now, I want y'all to understand something. It is not in my nature to get up and walk out of a movie.
It's true. You don't.
Boy, the emoji movie was torture. That was the Geneva Convention kind of stuff. This was similar torture. And when I could figure out where the ending was coming, I thought, you know what? I've got a book. It's sitting right here next to me by my side. It's right on the floor next to my seat. I have a book. And this movie has 15 minutes to go, I'm thinking. That's my guess, 15. Mm-hmm. I could spend the next 15 minutes of my life wanting to die. Or I could go out and read the book I have with me.
Well, sadly,
and that is what I did. And sadly, I did miss the scene with your friend.
You've met him too.
I've never met this man.
He's been in this apartment.
Nope.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
When?
Michael Cyril Creighton, co-star of Spotlight,
yes,
who came here because he was part of the ensemble that won the Independent Spirit Award.
Yes.
He and Gary and Cotty and I went to go walk around this neighborhood to find a Mexican restaurant.
Where
to
was
eat
I?
At. You were here. He came up and said hello.
I don't remember that.
Oh my God!
Where I must have been half asleep.
Who knows?
Are you sure it was me?
Yes, it was you.
What if it was my? What if that was Black Lodge me? You don't know.
Oh, God.
We live inside a dream, Alonzo.
Wait, what year is it?
What year is this?
What year is this?
Yeah.
Yes, you missed MCC's appearance.
I did. He was in it for like 3 seconds, right?
Basically.
Okay. And all right. I'm going to tell people what happens in this movie. Reese Witherspoon is the daughter of a famous filmmaker.
Right.
One of those, like, Cassavetes-style filmmakers, yes, of the 60s and 70s.
Yes. An Easy Rider, Raging Bull type.
Her mother, played by Candace Bergen, in just a few scenes, really.
Yeah.
Was the director's wife and muse, right, at the time. Somehow, some way, I can't even remember how, these three young 20-something interchangeables who are screenwriters, just on the cusp.
No, one's a director, one's a screenwriter, one's an actor.
Whatever.
They had an award-winning film at South by Southwest, and now they're in L.A. trying to get the feature made.
Can I digress for just a second about these three?
Sure.
One is played by an actor named Pico Alexander.
Yes, which sounds like directions.
If I ever meet this guy in person, I might have to be restrained from punching him in the face. I hope he's a really great guy. Because this film made me not only dislike his character, it made me dislike him personally. Like, he now has...
He has to overcome this film.
He has to overcome this movie for me in the future. He was in A Most Violent Year. I don't really remember him in Violent Year.
I don't remember him in War Machine, but everybody had crew cuts.
But on sight, I dislike this guy. I saw the What the Flick review where you and Christy were talking about it, and she was like, oh, I thought he was nice. And I was like, oh, yeah. Well, no, because he got them cheekbones. That's why you like him. Yeah, that was my thought. When you said, ew, I went, ew, too. Exactly. He plays the young, bland nothing pudding that Reese Witherspoon decides to get all girlish and crushy on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you feel embarrassed for her.
Yes.
You feel embarrassed for her character?
Like, if she
had, you feel embarrassed for her as an actor?
If she had hooked up with either of the other two guys, that would have been a little more understanding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But he's...
she picked the worst one.
He's, objectively speaking, the prettiest of the three.
Yes.
Like, the one that you can imagine having walked down runways in menswear, and he probably has.
Sure.
And so, obviously, because this film is boring and bland and banal and basic, she has to fall for the prettiest one.
Right.
And then they all move into her pool house.
Correct. They need a place to stay. They've been kicked out of the motel. That has the offensive Indian clerk
who yells
at them.
She's got kids, two kids. Her ex-husband is Michael Sheen.
He's back in New York.
He's back in New York, but he wants her back. And then nothing happens. Literally nothing happens. People talk about nothing. They have a scene where they talk about the thread count of the sheets in the bed. They go to some kids. One of the dumb kids has a pageant at school. They go to that. The kids are saying wise things to the adults, which, kid, do you want a spanking? Tell me something wise beyond your years. That's how you'll deserve a spanking. Everyone in this movie.
That's pretty much it in a nutshell.
They need to all go away forever.
This is the writing and directing debut of Hallie Myers Shire, who is the daughter of Charles Shire and Nancy Myers. Nancy Myers produced it. This feels like a Nancy Myers movie, except without the good kitchen.
Cheap.
Yes, without the good kitchen, the house isn't that great. I mean, it's...
The house is very luxurious.
It is spacious.
But it's not interesting to look at.
It has no personality.
It looks like it all comes from, like, some furniture store.
Yeah, like the Restoration Hardware catalog.
Yeah, yeah, there's nothing... It's not like, okay, remember the kitchen, and it's complicated. Remember how beautiful that kitchen was? And then remember how that kitchen wasn't good enough for Meryl Streep? She had to renovate the whole kitchen. And when she renovates the whole kitchen, you're like... Oh my God, that's an even better kitchen. And like, remember the houses in Holiday? What was that? Was it called
The Holiday?
The Holiday. And like, you had Kate Winslet's cozy little British cottage. And everything was just beautiful, and you wanted to snuggle up. And then Cameron Diaz's like incredible home where the blackout curtains, you push a button and they would automatically come down. I remember everything about the furniture and the homes in those movies.
Do you remember the plot?
No. the one with Diane Keaton where she gets naked, what's that
Something's
called?
Something's gotta give.
That house, that Hamptons.
Oh, that beach house.
Beach house. Yeah. Amazing house. It's all the... Boy, listen. I know it's a tired joke already. I know the making jokes about Nancy Myers' kitchens and homes and things like that in her films is already a tired, played-out joke. So I won't be making jokes about them. I will simply say that I'm a fan, an unironic fan of how rich people live in these films.
Yeah, her luxury
and I do not care about how the rich people in this movie live because they're boring and their furniture is boring and their sheets are boring and their lamps are boring and their kitchens are boring and they don't cook in kitchens like people cook. They cook cleanly and perfectly and happily. And
no one has a streak of flour on their forehead.
Well, there's
How
only
are we
two ways
know that they cook.
There's only two ways to cook in a movie: either
perfectly,
either antiseptically or chaotically. And so, I hate everything about this film. I wish that, like the 9/11 with Charlie Sheen, it never existed.
The other thing that's so annoying about this is that Ms. Myers-Shire grew up in Los Angeles, the child of two filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And so you'd think that she would write a movie about a woman who grew up in Los Angeles, the child of a filmmaker, and have some kind of insight into that. But she doesn't. I mean, anybody from Minnesota could have written this character because there's nothing specific or interesting about her. You would, you know, as I said in my review on The Wrap, like, these filmmaker guys who come sniffing around, she would have been fending them off her entire life.
Right.
And so that she's suddenly taken in by them, that Candace Bergen is taken in by them, like, oh, let's let them leave in the plus. I didn't buy that for a second. And yeah. It's like, where's your life in this, Hallie Myers-Shire? Where is the specificity that you're going to bring to this as somebody who lived a life that's sort of similar? What insight into the life of a kid who grew up in L.A., you know, with the privileged bubble of having filmmaker parents and living in that world and understanding that world, are you going to then bring into your movie? You're going to bring me a movie where it's all about getting to the child's pageant on time? Screw you.
That's me wiping my hands of everything.
Yes.
We're done with that movie. We're not talking about that ever again for the rest of our lives. Reese Witherspoon deserves better than this.
Yeah.
I don't know who she owed a favor to.
Well.
But she should not do this.
I think.
She should not do this sort of thing ever again.
She's going to make more HBO movies because that's the smart move, I think.
Good.
More limited series.
More films like Wild, which was fine.
Yeah. We still have to finish Big Little
Lies. Big Little Lies, that's fine too. Anything but this.
Anything but this.
All right. Now, I want to tell you about a film that you cannot watch.
Great.
Well, here's the thing. It is great.
Yes, I'm sure it is.
We have a foreign language distribution problem, foreign language film distribution problem in the United States.
We do.
They have to be a very specific sort of foreign language film. Now, we're lucky in that a lot of the recent Romanian filmmakers have gotten distribution in the United States.
Yes.
And why I'm saying Romanian is because the Romanian New Wave is a thing.
Yes.
For the past dozen or so years, a whole group of filmmakers out of Romania, of all places, have made some of the most interesting, sharply, you know, observed films, and some of the best films of the year.
I mean,
of the year they come out,
yeah.
They are often among the best.
I mean, 2007, a decade ago, is when 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days came out.
2005 is when The Death of Mr. Lazarescu came out.
Right.
Now, Cristi Puiu, mm-hmm. I'm going to probably say that name wrong, but that he was the director of The Death of Mr. Lazarescu.
Right.
His latest film is called Sierra Nevada. Sierra with one R. That title is never explained. It's kind of meaningless, or at least meaningless to me, after having watched the film. It played in Cannes. It played at the Cannes Film Festival.
In 2016?
2016. Got a little bit of a theatrical distribution in Europe in 2016, and more of a theatrical distribution in other European countries throughout this year. Mm-hmm. So it's still kind of rolling out theatrically over a year and a half-ish later.
Well, and last year, I think the guy who did 4 months, Christian Mungiu, had a film at Cannes called Graduation.
Graduation, which did get
some distribution.
American distribution, yes.
Not huge, but, you know, right. More than this movie.
Well, it's never huge.
Right,
you
but
know,
I mean,
like earlier last year in 2016, I saw a film called The Treasure that I really liked a lot.
Right.
And that played 1 week at the Lemley Royal, which is one of our art houses. And I don't know.
Did Tuesday After Christmas ever even open
here?
It did.
I don't know anyone I know who saw The Treasure. Justin? I think Justin saw it.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, Justin Chang. And so finally, after a year and almost a half, Sierra Nevada plays for one night in Los Angeles at the Downtown Independent Theater.
Right.
Brought to, it still lacks an official distribution deal in the United States, but is brought to the Downtown Independent by a group here in town called Acropolis. And it's two people, film critic Bob Kohler and another guy whose name I don't know. But they specialize once a month in bringing an undistributed art house thing to Los Angeles for at least a night.
Interesting.
Yeah. They did it over Labor Day weekend. Not a big crowd. Young Robbie joined me.
Mm-hmm.
Friend Robbie, art house Robbie. Metal Robbie. We went to on I guess it was Saturday night of Memorial Day weekend. Not Memorial Day weekend, Labor Day weekend. And there were about 25, 30 people there, which is, you know, huge for what this movie was.
I suppose, yeah.
So here's the thing. I tell you about this film knowing that at best you're probably going to get to watch it on a DVD soon-ish.
Or streaming.
Hopefully, you'll have a Region 2 capacity, an all-region DVD player. Because as of this moment, it may be my favorite film of the year. My favorite film that I've seen this year. 2016 movie, 2017, One Night in Los Angeles.
Had I not been in Venice, I would have totally gone with you.
I know why it didn't get distribution here. It is 3 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
And it is talk, 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 talk. So the subtitles come fast at you, and you've got to keep up. Furthermore, there are 14 principal characters.
Ooh, that's like two it's.
Yes. There are 14 principal characters in this film. It is set in a Bucharest apartment in January of approximately 2015, I think. Not long after the Charlie Hebdo situation, the terrorist attack in their office. But that's not exactly what the film's about. It's about a lot of different things. This family of 14 people gathers together for the memorial service for the grandfather. So there are children, grandchildren, cousins, aunts, uncles, the whole everything. There's a baby that's mostly off camera, but occasionally winds up in the shots. Often you just hear it crying. One of the young family members' friends is there, also largely unseen. She's a junkie. She's in the other room throwing up on everything. They are waiting for priests to show up to do an Orthodox ceremony related to the passing of the grandfather. Four priests eventually show up. You think the film is going to wind up being about waiting for these priests to show up, because they don't show up for like 90 minutes. And then you realize that what you're really going to be waiting for is the dinner that practically never happens, that they are constantly making throughout the film, like Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, where are we ever going to sit down and eat?
This also is kind of sounding to me like Altman's A Wedding.
Very much like Altman's A Wedding in that, but not formally.
Right, but just like a lot of characters, you don't necessarily always know who they are or how they're related to each other.
Information about what's going on in the apartment, why they are all there in the first place, is doled out in bits and pieces, and you are responsible for assembling the narrative in your head. Bits and pieces of information about who these family members are in relation to each other also doled out a little bit at a time. So you're watching the people and you're thinking, are you the mom? Are you the sister? Are you an aunt? Who are you married to? What's your story in all this? And again, bit by bit, you come to learn, you know, who they are, why they are. You also come to learn that they are grouchy a-holes, almost to a human. For the first 10 minutes of the film, I thought, this is the Duralde family. Because there are so many of them. And they are all talking at the same time. How will I keep up and focus on who's talking? And how will I know who is related to who in what way Because they're all speaking in Spanish to each other. And here they're all speaking, you know, Romanian. This movie makes you work for it. But it is such a pleasure to do that work. And what you realize that over the course of the film is that they're there for the memorial, but they're also there to bicker and argue and talk over each other and air grievances and talk about politics. One of the family members, one of the cousins, is a conspiracy theorist, so he's talking all about 9/11, you know, and what really happened. And he's talking about the Spanish July 11th, is that in Spain, the Madrid bombings in the subways? Talks about that. Charlie Hebdo comes up. There's an old communist grandmother in the mix who's like, put all the priests in jail and you kids don't know anything. And like, communism was fantastic. And you come to learn that the history of Romania and Eastern Europe is all sort of
unfolding and
tied up with this family. And the macro and the micro are playing and bouncing off against each other.
Interesting.
And it's not about just one thing. The whole is actually bigger than the parts. The camera sits usually in one place most of the time and just kind of like bounces back and forth, moves back and forth, because doors are opening and closing and people are moving from one room to the other, and people and conversations are going on across each other in different rooms. One conversation moves into another room and they'll say, well, what are they complaining about? And you know, it's a...
This kind of reminds me of H.R. Escola's The Family, which is all set inside one apartment, but over the course of like a century.
This is all set over the course of an afternoon.
Right.
And, oh God, it's so great.
Is it real time?
It feels like real time.
Interesting.
It can't possibly have been real time because the camera can't be in,
I'm not saying one shot, but I'm saying...
But it takes place over the course of what is essentially real time.
Huh, fascinating.
It is, in terms of ensemble acting, staggering to watch these 14, 20, if you count the baby, the puking junkie, and the priests... 20 people interacting seamlessly, and it just bounces. They all bounce off each other.
Oh, wow.
It's incredible.
I very much want to see it.
When and if you get a chance to see Sierra Nevada by director Christy Puyu, do it.
And for those of you who, we occasionally get emails from people who say that they jot down movies that we talk about. If you're interested in the Romanian New Wave, check out 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. Check out The Death of Mr. Lazarescu. Check out 1201 East of Bucharest.
Yeah.
And Police Adjective.
Police Adjective, yes.
Tuesday After Christmas.
The Treasure.
The Treasure.
Graduation.
Graduation and Sierra Nevada.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's other ones. Those are the ones we know.
I love these movies.
I'm a fan.
And I love this director. This director is... so talented. He has become the kind of filmmaker whose work I anticipate now.
I'm the same way with Munju, and I'm sure I'll be for this after I see this one too. But cool. What's your DVD pick?
While you were gone, I had a chance to dig back into my John Ford self-education.
Right.
I'm still in the 20s and 30s, because that man made an F-ton of movies.
Yeah, he did.
I watched Aerosmith with Ronald Coleman and Helen Hayes. Young Helen Hayes.
Yes.
He's a doctor, and he...
based on a Sinclair Lewis novel?
Based on a Sinclair Lewis novel, and he gets married to a nurse, and she's a sassy nurse. She does not back down from him. When he treats her, you know, condescendingly in the first scene. And by the end of the scene, he's asking her to dinner. And by the end of dinner, they're agreeing to marry each other. So it's like, you know, things move very quickly.
He's met his match.
Yeah, yeah. And he goes off to the Dominican Republic, Haiti, Barbados, one of those places that I'm blanking. I watched it in 100-degree heat, so forgive me. to come up with a cure for the plague.
Ooh.
It's got that early 30s casual overt racism that that is so much a part of early American cinema. And yet, at the same time, it is valuable to watch because you are seeing John Ford become more the filmmaker that he would become. You know, his directorial style, you know, he's building it in these early films. But more to the point, young Helen Hayes, who, you know, again, it's pre-feminism, but it's also the feminism of its moment.
Sure.
Where she is not to be told. And no matter what he says to her, she says, well, here are my ideas. So it's an interesting movie. If you are like me and you like to go back and pick a filmmaker or pick an actor and just start at the beginning and follow through their career, which is, now that I've done it mostly for Judy Garland and I've started doing it with Barbara Stanwyck and I'm deep now into the John Ford, it's such a good self-film education project. I recommend pick somebody and put their name in your, you know, whatever DVR you got, and go hunt down their early stuff and start from the beginning and do it. I learn more about like their place in history by doing this.
By watching them progress.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, because it is such
A-A-R-R-O-W.
Yes. Not like the band.
Not the band. No. Yeah.
Because it is such a big deal this weekend, and because it is so quickly taken for itself a specific iconography, I thought I would recommend the classic French film, The Red Balloon.
Did you see they were handing out red balloons in the lobby?
No, I didn't.
There were employees.
The red balloon has become very key to the marketing of this film, and it's as an image. It is a recurring visual, you know, thing throughout the film. But the original Red Balloon is a completely different movie, and a very sweet movie, and a very kid-friendly movie, none of which it is, but a great film nonetheless. And it's one of those movies that when you if you've never seen it before, it will almost feel familiar because so many movies over the years have borrowed from it, have parodied it, have referenced it. But it's worth seeing the actual thing, and there's a great Criterion version of it. So yeah, if you've never seen it, The Red Balloon.
And then watch Hu Xiaoxian's Flight of the Red Balloon.
I knew you were going to say
which
that.
Is again one of the things that references
yes.
The Red Balloon. Yes, 2007, yes. Julia Binoche.
Right.
Do it.
Letters.
I got one. A ghost story letter.
Mm.
This is from July. This letter comes back yes. all the way from back in July. From Julius. Oh, it's kind of a long letter. Give me a minute to read you this whole thing then.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
I don't interrupt like some
This may get into spoiler territory, he says.
Well, good thing we waited 2 months to read it.
Yeah. I saw a ghost story last night and I thought there was a big dimension that was missing from the discussion. Our discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Given your usual sensitivity to racial topics in cinema, I'm surprised you didn't talk about the racial aspects presented in A Ghost Story, a film about white fragility and the fear that a white man isn't the most important thing in the world. Okay.
Go on.
All right. In the first half, the white sheeted ghost of Casey Affleck is a fine representation of the memory of a loved one, as Rooney Mara goes through her grieving process. But the second half changes the interpretation of the ghost from a physical representation of memory into a representation of the tragedy that we won't all leave our mark on society in a meaningful way, unlike the everlasting Beethoven. This contemplation is filtered through the lens of whiteness, and David Lowery's fear that a white man may not always be the most important center of everything. Here are three scenes that I think are important to this reading. Number one, the only family that Casey Affleck actively poltergeists on screen is a poor Spanish-speaking family headed by a single mother. Why does Casey Affleck break all of the dishes and glasses of this Mexican family? Because he's upset his girlfriend has moved on. No other reason. Number two, the next group to cohabit the house is a party of supernatural-obsessed white hipsters where a drunken white dude holds court to shout at people that we're all eventually going to die and our legacy might be forgotten, but our residue is forever, even if it won't be as big of an impact as Beethoven has had. If anybody needed terrorizing, it's this guy. That's a fact. But all we see is a kitchen light bulb getting brighter, and then a jump cut to a destroyed, ravaged house. Did the ghost terrorize them and rip up the walls and tear out the sink? Was this the work of punks or the developers tearing down the house? Who knows? All we do know is that this is the last group of inhabitants, and it was a group of white people, and they don't deserve to be terrorized on screen. By the film's estimation.
Right.
Number three. Then there's the time that the ghost is hanging around in a field to see the white pilgrims put the first stake where the ghost's house will eventually be, but they are killed off-screen, presumably by a bunch of Native Americans trying to protect their land from the white invaders. Of course, we never see the Native Americans, and David Lowery never contemplates the idea that the white pilgrims are invading a space occupied by another people. Instead, this is seen as a tragedy where white people were killed by non-white people, and we watch the family's bodies decay into nothingness. On these bodies, the house will be built. The presence of the white family is held as important and central to the story, while the Native Americans are erased from the film's history. I don't believe the film is self-aware enough to be critiquing these tropes in the American narrative. Instead, I believe that Lowery believed he was being sensitive by making the next family be Spanish-speaking Mexicans and not depicting racist stereotypes of Native Americans, even if he still included those narrative tropes in his story. These aspects marred what was otherwise a not terrible meditation on grief with amazing cinematography and sound mixing. Although, if I'm mentally singing the Proclaimers, I would walk 500 miles while a ghost is trudging through fields of grass, something is terribly wrong. Am I looking for bones to pick? Am I imagining or inflating these racial aspects? What are your thoughts on this? Sincerely, Julius from the Solute.
Solute.com.
That's his site.
It's interesting that you bring this up because there was something else that I wanted to say about it that I had forgotten about.
Okay.
One of the kids, the main kids who call themselves the Losers Club, is black, and he is tormented by the bullies who go after all of the kids in the movie, very specifically because he is black. And it is 1989,
uh-huh.
And the bully never uses the N-word.
Right.
And I don't know that that's honest.
It's not.
And I worry that...
Because he would have, because he's a horrible person.
Yes. Yeah. I worry that white filmmakers trying to err on the side of caution and not do the wrong thing, i.e. Sofia Coppola in The Beguiled, possibly David Lowery in Ghost Story... are then going to decide that invisibility is better than potential offensiveness.
Right.
And so...
I just scanned through the next letter. It's the same subject.
No kidding.
Yes. This is from Joe.
Okay.
I saw a ghost story last Friday, July 28th, same a week later this letter came. And while I did like a large amount of it, particularly Rooney Mara and the overall aesthetic, there are a few instances where the film either completely alienated me or turned me and many others off as well. First, the drunken monologue. Having a random character force the main thesis statement upon the audience unnaturally through a smug, nihilistic 3-minute speech near the end felt lazy. At first, I thought it might have been a moment of satire, like both of you rightfully thought. It seems like the most logical conclusion. But then I came across an interview of director David Lowery, basically saying that he had wanted to include this monologue in a film for years. He wrote it years ago. And he personally believes what it says. Knowing this really soured my opinion on the film, and I didn't know if you guys knew about that. Lastly, what are both of your thoughts on Laurie's decision to subtitle the dialogue of the ghosts in the film, but not the dialogue of the Spanish-speaking family later on in the film? In this political and cultural climate, I personally found that choice to be greatly misguided and uncomfortable. It was a decision that reminded me of how Sofia Coppola's The Beguiled was handled regarding the slave character, borderline racist undertones. I'm really curious to hear what you both have to say. I love the main idea of this film, and even think the opening 20 minutes or so are almost a tribute to slow cinema. A ghost story left me completely frustrated and disappointed as a viewer. Especially a viewer who was very excited for it. Thanks again, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, I had forgotten about the non-subtitling thing. It does sort of, the movie is basically saying, you don't need to know this. It's not, what they have to say isn't important.
I have to go back and rewatch this movie now because,
I mean,
I'll tell you guys.
I speak Spanish, so it wasn't a problem for me, but right. Yeah, but the movie is not operating under that assumption.
I'll tell y'all, I thought this was a film about grief.
They're not saying it isn't a film.
No. I mean, only. So, I need a rewatch.
All right.
So I can think about this stuff.
I think there's nothing in either of these letters that makes me think. That makes me think that I want to disagree. Like I don't have anything to say counter to any of these arguments. And,
right.
And yeah, the fact that the Native Americans are never seen,
right,
and that the death of the white settlers is treated like a tragedy when they are interlopers on the land of the Native Americans.
Right.
Yeah, I think these are all valid points. So, I would need to see the movie again with that in mind, but I think you guys are both onto something here.
That's the end of all film discussion. Forever.
Until next time.
Here's you guys what for you should do.
What's that?
We have these black linoleum knife t-shirts.
Mm.
They're black t-shirts. They're all cotton. They say linoleum knife across the chest in big white, blocky, you know, stark, well-designed letters.
Yes.
People will ask you, what the heck does that mean? And you will tell them. It's a podcast of the cinema hosted by these two gay dudes that are actually married to each other. And then they'll be like, nope, never have to listen to that. But you'll still enjoy wearing the t-shirt. They are $22. You can PayPal us. And we have all the sizes. Uh-huh. We have lady sizes. We have man sizes. We got kid sizes. Linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
If you are outside the United States, drop
us. Ask us first, and we'll tell you that the postage is going to be a hell of a lot more.
Drop us an email first and tell us where, and we'll tell you how much more. But if you're in the U.S., PayPal is $22. Linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know where you want to send it, what size you want, and we'll get that taken care of.
I'll tell you another thing.
What's that?
We have three other podcasts. Three.
Count them.
They cost money.
They do.
One's called LKTV. It's this, but about television.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other one is called Linoleum Knife and Fork. It's this, but all the times we stop and talk about food, that's the whole thing.
Food.
It's about food. Then there's Linoleum Nights, which is about a whole lot of things, and we unleash our full vocabularies.
That's true. That is the podcast of bad swears, and we talk about you touchy subjects.
You go to Patreon, Linoleum Knife.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
And you look at those different levels of podcast listening, money paying, and stuff getting, because you get stuff too depending on your level, and you'll like it. Maybe try it for a month. It's $4.
Yeah, why not?
That's the cheap version. I'm always selling that $4 version.
$4, $7.
What else you got to say? Who should they listen to?
Well, go listen to Who Shot Ya, the new show that I'm on. That's on the Maximum Fun Network. It's a lot of fun, and I'm hoping that it's you know, a thing that will.
You're
stick
in
around.
The podcast big leagues now.
It's kind of crazy, yeah.
I'm not, no, but you but, are.
Well, we've both been on Pop Rocket in the last few weeks.
Yeah,
so
but I'm a pinch hitter.
Well, nonetheless, there.
And you, I don't listen. I've listened to me on Pop Rocket now, and I've listened to you on Pop Rocket now. You're better at Pop Rocketing than I am. No, you are. You fit everyone better. I love all three of those people. They're all wonderful and funny and cool. But You're a more seamless addition. Well,
go listen to our episodes and judge for yourself, listeners. In the meantime, you can also go to ChrissyLemire.com, listen to Cancel Too Soon with Dibs and Whitney and The Schmoes Know, and Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, and The Sewers of Paris and The Comics Canon, and Fat Guys of the Movies and The Criterion Cast, and Film Spotting SVU and Secretly Timid. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Linoleum Cast. You should go review us and subscribe to us at iTunes. You could also leave us feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com and Google Play and Podbean and CastBox. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. You're awesome. Go to Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia, to hear what he's up to.
I made a clunky, noisy sound there.
And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com about movies you liked or movies you thought were stealth racist or other things you want to talk about. And we would love to hear from you. And until next time,
goodbye.